Welcome to Mindful Education. My name is Daniel Rekshoff, and I'm here today with my friend and my esteemed guest, David Trelevin. He holds a PhD in psychology. He teaches at the doctoral psychology program at California Institute of Integral Studies. And the main reason that I have him on today is to talk about his new book that will be coming out soon, called Trauma Sensitive Mindfulness. And I'm really interested to be able to bring a dialogue around mindfulness and education and how to do that in a trauma sensitive way, how to do that in a socially conscious, diversity conscious way. And David is really an expert both on trauma and on talking about social justice and diversity. And so we're going to really dive in and get his expertise and his viewpoint on how to do the work we do of bringing mindfulness and social emotional learning into schools with a trauma sensitive approach. So welcome, David. And I guess my first question would be, in what way, what do we need to think about when we're going to be teaching mindfulness to young people? Like what type of starting places do we have if we want to do it in a trauma-sensitive way?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I've experienced the last year is that whenever I'm doing a talk on trauma and mindfulness, people that are new to me and new to the topic, they'll often have the assumption that I'm going to talk primarily about, well, where can mindfulness help when it comes to trauma, which it can, you know. And part of the focus that I've had in my work and research and now with this book is to say that I think what teachers and what any mindfulness educator needs to have their eye to with the work is to say there are ways that mindfulness can both benefit people who have experienced trauma or are actively experiencing it, and there's also a way that mindfulness can actually create some problems for people, for kids or students or really anyone that's had a traumatic experience. And so that I think as a teacher, the key is just to go into any classroom, any situation where you're teaching mindfulness and have an awareness that, okay, this isn't a panacea. You know, this is a fantastic, incredible practice and skill that's been practiced and taught over thousands of years. And everyone's different. Everyone's going to come in here with a different social context, different experience, and potentially experiences with trauma. So in the work, I want to be really having a common sense approach to this and not be too high-minded about it and trust that teachers will know how to move skillfully with students because, you know, that's what they're trained to do. Mm-hmm. But that's what I think the main starting point of this conversation is to say there are both benefits and potential drawbacks. And we just need to go into it with our eyes wide open and looking at what both those can be.
So let's do both of those then. Why don't we start with the positives? How can mindfulness be supportive to somebody who has trauma?
That's a big question. I think the shortest answer to that question is that mindfulness has been shown through research to really support self-regulation, right? So we have the ability to actually regulate our attention. We're more able to regulate our emotions and work skillfully in terms of being able to attune with ourselves emotionally. And then it also increases body awareness. And all those things, when it comes to being in a process of trauma recovery or trying to work with managing trauma, those are all incredibly valuable skills to be able to have. So to basically provide a trauma survivor with a tool which says, here's something that can enable you to actually manage symptoms that you might have, to be able to regulate your arousal or your state of awakeness, is it can be a huge gift. It can be a really big gift.
Do you have an example, like if somebody was having some type of traumatic experience, and what would they do? Like, what is something, a practice or something that they might, do you have like some example
for
of
sure
that?
Yeah, for sure. So for those of for people that are listening that have know something about trauma, a lot of people will have heard that people who experience trauma often have something called flashbacks, where they're having intrusive memories or images or thoughts, and are reliving a traumatic experience. Now, often when I'm talking about trauma, I'll be talking about it as a past event. And we also want to be conscientious here of the fact that, you know, teachers could be working with students who are actively experiencing trauma in the present moment. But with these flashbacks, what's happened, this can happen for people that are either meditating or doing a mindfulness practice, is that all of a sudden you can be inundated with an image, a repetitive thought, but basically you're reliving some experience of what was an overwhelming traumatic event. Where mindfulness can be incredibly helpful is that it's a present moment centered form of attention. And it's actually, I mean, people talk about it differently, but the idea that it's anchoring us in a very visceral and practical way to the present moment is really helpful for a trauma survivor. So, you know, I will work with individuals who are going through a process of trauma recovery. And just to give a quick example, where if someone had their eyes closed and was experiencing a flashback, that being mindful that they are actually in my office or they're in the present moment, it's 2016, that can be an incredibly powerful and quick way for them to actually almost like Velcro, to unstick from a traumatic experience which is overwhelming them. Now, sometimes that can be from opening your eyes. That can be just as simply as orienting to the space. But mindfulness is about arriving fully in the present moment for what's there. So to give survivors or people that have experienced trauma a tool which says, here's a way that we can actually help you keep coming back over and over to the present when you have, when there are parts of you that are going to be wanting to be pulled into the past, that's the way that it can turn out to be a really practical and powerful both power of mind and also something that they can practice.
And how do you imagine that could be helpful for learning for a kid in a class, kids in a classroom? Because I imagine that, you know, I working in Oakland schools and different schools, any privileged schools, underprivileged schools, kids who've, whether it's, you know, a sibling has been incarcerated, or whether it's a parent family that's just been divorced or whatever, coming into the classroom, and obviously the mind's still Velcroed, as you're saying, to that experience. Mm-hmm. And then it's pretty hard to memorize times tables when that's the experience.
Yeah. This is a key, it's a big component of the framework that I've been interested in and wanting to forward, is that trauma-sensitive practice isn't just a collection of, it's not a box to check. It's really not to say, oh, by doing just XYZ, then I'm trauma-informed or I'm trauma-sensitive. That the argument I want to make and that other people are making is that to speak about trauma, we're naturally talking about social context. Trauma isn't just an individual experience that someone goes through once and it's over. Trauma is actually connected. It's inseparable from a system of from a social context and systems of both privilege and oppression, which are shaping us all the time in different ways. So I was trained to think about trauma, and a lot of us are trained to think about trauma as this bad thing that happened to this person, where in actuality, trauma is incredibly complex and opens up a whole conversation about ways that kids and ways that people are harmed within a family system, within larger institutions, or within systems of oppression. So what I'd say to the teachers here, and to try to answer your question, is that when we're moving into a classroom of students that are going to come in with a very diverse range of experiences, that we want to be attuned to the social context that they're coming in with in the class. And what by that I mean that we want to not only be sensitive to how mindfulness is impacting them in the present moment, but we want to have a context to how they might be receiving teachings. Like you said, the example of someone whose family is incarcerated, a family member who's incarcerated. We want to have a deep sensitivity to that mindfulness. We're not just offering it as a way to basically blow sunshine and make everything better. And, you know, you and I have talked about this, about the ways that mindfulness can be kind of an overlay to having people to try to conform, to get kids to behave well. And instead, I think trauma-informed practice is to say, okay, here's a tool, here's something that we're offering kids, and we're throwing a rock into a pond here, and let's be really attuned to what can happen and the different circumstances that people are facing outside of the classroom, and let's just stay real time with these kids and students about, hey, how was that for you? Mm-hmm. Did that help? And if it didn't help, that we can have some particular modifications, which is the work I'm interested in, to say, hey, here's a way that mindfulness could work for you, and let's have that conversation on the side.
And I love what you're saying, and you know, because there's the, you're talking about a specific practice, like you're saying, I'm gonna orient towards the room or feel my feet on the ground, and that's gonna help me, bring me back to the present moment if I'm having a trauma reenactment or I'm having, you know, these encroaching trauma thoughts or whatever it is. But then what you're naming further is saying something like trauma sensitivity as a mindfulness practice.
Totally. I'll give you an example of it. So I was talking to a teacher who was doing a mindful class, and one of the students could see, you know, a couple times had was tracking the class and seeing how everyone was doing with this brief guided meditation, and saw that one of the students was struggling, you know, was having a hard time with it and was distracted. And the teacher, she said, you know, if it had been a year earlier, she might have thought that the person was acting out, that the student was just pushing back and didn't like the class. And instead, she just let herself be curious. And, you know, they finished the meditation and the small practice, and then she had a conversation with him on the side and say, hey, you know, hey, how was that for you? What'd you notice? And the student said, you know, I couldn't actually escape this one repetitive thought that I kept having about something hard that happened to me. And it opened a conversation that ended up being really helpful for both the student and the teacher. And so I think to your point that the work, it is for teachers to stay, this is part of your work, I know, is teachers need to stay present and attuned and mindful as well when they're offering these practices, and letting themselves be curious and non-judgmental and say, gosh, I wonder how this is impacting this student. And instead of trying to, you know, discipline them or assume that the practice isn't good for them, to be able to engage them and say, hey, you know, what worked and what didn't work for you? And let's just have a real-time conversation about whether mindfulness is a practice that can actually support the student and the class in general.
One thing that you're putting in there is like that makes me think about compassion, where you're saying this friend of yours who's aware of their classroom because of more trauma sensitivity, more mindfulness, she's able to not be as reactive to the kid, but is able to look a little more deeply and see what's going on for this kid, to inquire and to actually understand, but to, you know, two different kind of mindfulness themes, one of which is compassion, the other one is around kind of interconnectedness or kind of understanding what's going on in our world and how it's affecting us, how we're affecting it. So I'm interested in that how that fits in, I guess, both kind of the self-compassion and the external compassion to in the kind of trauma work.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that trauma does is it fundamentally impacts and can sever connection. And that can happen both at the level of an individual inside of a student. And that can also be happening inside of family and community and inside of systems. I think this is where trauma is actually an incredible lens that we, as people who are doing mindfulness-based work, can look at and say, wow, we can really look at the way that people are, both people are impacted and communities are impacted by harm. And trauma impacts safety, it impacts dignity, and it can really leave people feeling, especially young people, feeling helpless, feeling, you know, almost just shattered, that people, that the people who were meant to look after them maybe didn't show up the way that they needed, or in worst case scenarios caused them harm. You know, a lot of trauma happens within intimate partnerships and within families. And so when trauma, because trauma has such a devastating impact on connections, on both safety and an inner form of connection, it can produce a lot of shame. And a lot of students and people who have experienced trauma can come in feeling fundamentally broken or flawed or just fundamentally unsafe and not okay. And so the compassion aspect of mindfulness, again, in this frame that we're talking about where mindfulness can help with someone who's experienced trauma, is to actually start repairing the bonds of disintegration that happen both inside and happen with other people. I think this is a complex conversation that we could talk about for a long time. But on the simplest level, imagining a student, I mean, I've seen this with students, I've seen it with clients, of just seeing a student place their hand on their chest and direct some compassion towards themselves and say, God, this has been really intense. Like, what I'm going through is really hard. Can I actually let in some compassion towards myself? That's a huge move, and that opens the possibility of also receiving compassion from, say, a teacher. So I think mindfulness, it's not about just bare awareness of overwhelming experiences that happen. It's actually bringing some heart into the relationship that one has with themselves, with other people, and saying, whoa, can our hearts open here to the level of pain that this student's experiencing? So this is, it's big, deep work. I mean, we're in the deep end of the pool.
And I found, you know, I feel like I've been learning a whole lot about trauma-sensitive mindfulness just by jumping into that deep end of the pool, and, you know, amazing sometimes and hard others. And the example you just brought up made me think about how sometimes I lead a kind of heartfulness practices where we do exactly what you're saying, where we send ourselves, put a hand on the heart and send ourselves some kindness. Or another one that I've, and this is maybe where I'll shift into the second question of how mindfulness can actually, if not cause harm, maybe not be helpful or all of that, of inviting, when I've invited students or teachers to do a practice where they picture in their mind's eye kind of some people who love them, you know, like a, or, you know, maybe even if it's hard to picture that, a pet that comes and sits by you or something. Having kids picture a loving experience. And often when you do that, what is generated inside is a sense of relaxation and soothing and this kind of ease. And so it's a beautiful way to be able to generate pretty quickly an experience of kind of attunement or inner compassion. What I have experienced, though, on the other side, is sometimes when I invite kids to do that, or teachers to do that, I get the opposite. And people will say, I tried, and I couldn't picture any caregivers. And so it actually hits that shame button that you're talking about, where it's like, instead of generating a sense of relaxation or love, it creates a sense of, I don't have any of that in my life. I feel lonely. I feel sad. I feel, what's wrong with me? So yeah, I wonder that as a, you know, that's one way that I've noticed of like, oh, this is a way a mindfulness practice can have the opposite effect. So I wonder if that opened for you, like in what other ways can, if mindfulness doesn't have a trauma, because I think that on some level, for me, that what you're talking about of systems of oppression or awareness of social dynamics, the more I become aware of the people I teach, I'm aware of, oh, maybe the kids I'm teaching are living in, don't have parents, and maybe they're living in a really hard situation, and you know, I become more sensitive to, oh, maybe I don't say picture yourself sitting with your family, you know, which I maybe once would have assumed, you know, and now I become more sensitive and think, how do I language this? How do I do this in a sensitive way to be able to help them create that sense of inner safety and love without triggering or without pushing them past a point? So yeah, so I wonder what things you find around might have the wrong effect.
I think that with mindfulness, it's not an overlay practice. We're inviting people into a relationship with what's true in the present moment, and that's intense. That's really this is the whole piece around trauma-sensitive mindfulness, is that if you're a teacher and you're doing a mindfulness-based practice, you're inviting people into connection with resilience, but you're also potentially, you know, inviting them into connection with trauma. And I don't just mean individual trauma, I mean you're connecting them also to the news report they saw the day before of either, it could be police violence, or the news of some kind of mass shooting. And that's, I think, the key piece when if we're shifting gears to talk about where trauma or where mindfulness can be dysregulating or cause problems for students who are practicing mindfulness, is to say, you, by virtue of you inviting someone to pay attention, just that, you're inviting someone into contact with trauma, especially if they are actively experiencing traumatic stress. So I'll unpack what I mean by that. And here's a story. I was on a retreat a couple years ago, and what I realized on the retreat, what happened on the retreat, was that I kept feeling a certain tightness in my chest, and I'd be mindful of it. And generally, my experience with practice was that if I'm mindful of something, eventually it shifts. And it was different for me. Something kept really coming back. And eventually, the more I was mindful of this sensation, it followed me to a memory where I was like, oh, wow, this is actually connected to a trauma. It's actually connected to a time that I was really overwhelmed. And what happens for trauma survivors is that the trauma continues to live on in the body and the mind. And this is what we need to know as educators, is that trauma doesn't end. This is what's so insidious about traumatic stress, is that it ends up circulating in one's consciousness, in the mind and the body. And what that means is that when someone is being mindful, eventually they bump in to a physical sensation, a thought, a memory, something that relates to a trauma. Now, often that's not going to be a big problem, but if you follow that thread far enough, you can end up actually really connecting with the overwhelming experience in the first place. And this is where people can get re-traumatized. If I'm a kid in a classroom and I'm being invited to pay attention to my body, and all I can feel is a tight throat that relates to a traumatic experience, at some point I might actually feel that I'm right back in that traumatic experience. And so this is where we need to be really attuned and mindful as educators in the present moment, and saying, how is the practice impacting someone in a present moment way?
Yeah, so important. And part of that also, because I imagine you being a therapist and somebody who actually works with individuals, I do this myself. Sometimes for me, and I'm assuming for you, there's actually, alone in my therapy room, there's actually an invitation to open some of that kind of the trauma file, and then you actually can have a restorative kind of curative experience with it to some extent, because there's a container in which they can notice what's coming up in a well-paced and well-held way. But there's a big question to that of, if you're in a classroom, or if you're in a setting where the people who are there don't really understand what's going on or aren't empathic. So I wonder about the container and what needs to happen for somebody to be able to, if that does get triggered, to have it not just feel like a shameful thing once again.
That's a great point. I mean, I want to be clear that I'm not saying that if someone who has experienced trauma or is actively experiencing trauma, that if they go through mindfulness practice, that that's necessarily a bad thing. Actually, it can be a great thing. I mean, people can have really powerful experiences in a classroom, in a meditation hall. It's not all bad. But to your point, the piece that you're saying about the container, I think, is so key. And I would say that the responsibility lies on the part of the one who's offering mindfulness practice. So I'll say, because this is your audience here, is to mindfulness teachers, that the whole punchline that I'm trying to make with this work is to say, just know your competence and know your boundary. Know the container that you want to work in. And especially to not, basically to not do trauma work. Just to don't do, if you're a teacher and you're in a classroom and you know that a student is going through active trauma and you can feel that the practices that you're doing are bringing stuff up, you know, don't play fast and loose with this. That there's a good reason that someone has compartmentalized an experience, and just welcoming that back up can actually have serious consequences for people. At worst, it leads to re-traumatization.
So you're saying kind of to honor the defenses that they have to some extent.
Exactly. And to not only you're honoring the defense and that you're making sure that you're not setting someone up for failure. I think this is the key for anyone bringing in any kind of mindfulness practice is, how can we make sure that every single student is going to leave this experience happier, healthier, more integrated, and that we turn stress down and not up. This woman named Babette Rothschild, who's a fantastic trauma specialist who's written a number of books, one of her core principles around trauma work is to say, are we turning pressure up in the system or are we turning pressure down? And if you as a teacher realize that the practices that you're offering are turning something up, then the move to me is that you either refer on to the counselor in the school, you make sure that the student's connected to a trauma professional, that you don't just keep on and cross your fingers and hope for the best. That's where we need to be very clean and clear and mindful as educators to say, I know where the boundaries of my competence is, and I know when to refer, and that I'm tracking the students to see, is pressure being turned up in the system of the classroom or of the kids, of the student, or is this actually making people feel happier and healthier?
That's brilliant. And I find from my work with kids in schools, you know, there seems to be a certain range of practices that I haven't really seen any kind of trauma responses or any type of, or the heat going up. Like, mostly when we're just doing kind of focusing with the eyes or listening or doing some awareness. I often do feeling sensations of the hands or the feet and, you know, all the things that kind of playful mindfulness games, all about just developing awareness. But where I do find it, and you've kind of pointed to this, is when I start inviting kids to be aware of the sensations that are kind of in the midsection of the body. If I'm like telling people, like, just feel what's going, even the breath sometimes. And definitely when I invite kids to particularly look into their emotions. And, you know, I have a very particular setup of, you know, what we do before we look into our emotions. But that's, that's definitely an arena where if we are asking kids to look into what's going on in the emotional realm, we have to expect that if there's a lot going on in the emotional realm, they're looking at it.
Totally. I mean, a student who's actively experiencing trauma, the breath often isn't neutral. Or the inner world. Their inner world is not neutral. Bessel van der Kolk is one of these great, who's written a fantastic book on trauma called The Body Keeps the Score. Talks about trauma. For someone who's experienced trauma, the body can become a minefield. It really can. And at any moment, you can unexpectedly trip a wire or step on a landmine and suddenly be thrown right back into a traumatic experience. And it's unexpected. You don't see it coming. It catches people off guard. So I do think that there's something that's... we want to be very... Well, I'll say it this way. There's traditionally, I think, in mindfulness practice, the assumption that you work with the breath as a neutral anchor of attention. And I know that in mindfulness education, you're working much more dynamically than saying, hey kid, or hey student, go sit down for 45 minutes and pay attention to your breath. At the same time, I think it's important for us, for those of us who are working in the mindfulness field, to know, right, anchors of attention aren't always neutral. We can actually work with different anchors, and I think the teachers that you work with are experimenting with different ways of being mindful. It's not just about plunking yourself down for 30 minutes and just honing in on the breath. You can pay attention to hearing. You can pay attention to the sensation of your hand touching a blanket, or like you were just saying about the kids making movements with their bodies. That's fantastic. And just know, nothing is neutral for someone who's survived trauma. They often need the help of someone who's working with them one-to-one to actually help them connect with what is resilient for them. Where are the safe places inside their body? It's not always obvious and they need help. So again, this is where we just want to be competent about, does this student need help outside of what I can offer them? What's the container that I can provide? And still, mindfulness is mostly going to be often really great for all students, including people that have experienced trauma, but we just want to have our eye to it.
So awesome, so informative. I think that for a kind of last question, we've looked through, as you said, mindfulness, you know, paradoxically, most kind of trauma trainings, a lot of the interventions are kind of mindfulness practices, like being aware of our bodies, coming into the present moment. So it's this incredible antidote to some extent for mindfulness, and at the same time, I mean for trauma, and then at the same time, it can elicit trauma if we're not sensitive by going in and looking too closely, too directly, without the right support. So I'm also just interested for people as they've been listening to this, we all, adults, you know, you're talking about the minefield, like it's impossible to get to 20 or 30 or 40 or 50, however old we are, without having some traumas with a little T or a big T. So I'm just interested what recommendations you'd have for folks individually if they're thinking, hey, I want to both be aware of how to work with any of the traumas I've experienced, or how to be more particularly sensitive to the traumas of the kids that I'm working with.
That's great. I mean, it's a big question. It's kind of the topic of the book, really, is to say...
Buy the book.
Yeah, put a link to it. Well, I'd say this, that mindfulness, in my experience, the more that I've learned and worked with the intersection of trauma and mindfulness, it's that mindfulness it's not a panacea. And that if it becomes the main course practice that someone is spending, say, 75-80% of their own time focused on, it can be limiting. And I mean, I've met a lot of people who, it can be a great home base of a practice. And I think where I would encourage, and it will naturally evoke eventually the traumas that one has encountered in one's life. I mean, Reggie Ray, if you know Reggie Ray from Shambhala world, or used to be with Chogyam Trungpa and is now in Colorado, talks about, you know, he's been a deep meditator for decades. I mean, really 50 years. And then just hit upon a major childhood trauma in his practice in a silent retreat that was over a couple months. So I think there is an incredibly beautiful cleansing process within mindfulness to just be paying attention consistently over and over that will eventually evoke trauma. But to look to mindfulness to heal that trauma, that's a big ask. It's a big ask. So I'd say, even though this can open up part two of our conversation, is to say, well, then what? What do you do once you get there? Now, mindfulness can be it's essential, I'd say, I mean, invaluable as a resource to actually integrating that trauma, but inside of other methodologies. So I'm a big proponent of, and I'm sure a lot of the folks who will be listening to this are too, of different methodologies. So, you know, therapy's great. Body-based practices are also fantastic. We need to work skillfully with different aspects of our experience that mindfulness and meditation alone can't always touch. So take the mindfulness and then just open up. Again, you'll see it in the book, but you know, there's like a number of different modalities that we can be working with where mindfulness can actually slingshot us towards the integration of trauma and managing our symptoms really effectively if we're willing to pair it with different teachers and approaches.
Because it makes me think about the question of when there's trauma, there's a question of like, is it good or bad to have that trauma brought out? Like, because we don't want to just live our whole lives with traumas just kind of pushed down and squashed because that's really difficult for a system. Somebody with trauma, where that trauma doesn't have any space to be able to be healed, is living a very kind of blocked life. And so there's that question of, we actually want, on some level, that trauma to be able to be open to the air, but of course only if it's met with these practices that you're talking about. And you're saying body-based, whether it's some type of movement practice or whether it's type of therapeutic healing practice, all these different things that will be able to meet that emerging trauma.
I think this is a great place to close, actually, around this piece, is when I meet teachers and educators who you can really feel that their heart is in their work. I mean, I've met great people through the mindfulness education community. And one of the qualities that they seem to have, which I think is so beautiful, is that they are an invitation to growth, transformation, and learning. And I always have this image of them that when a student, young person, or a teenager would come to them in a kind of open-hearted way and say, hey, I want to learn about this, that they are there to receive them in a profound way. I think this is what teachers do, is that they're constantly receiving and catching students and saying, I'm right here. I'm right here to be with you in your learning and your growth and development. I think there's something so profound about that. Trauma, to me, it's the same thing. When trauma is evoked and there's a moment, it's often younger parts of us, or it can be parts that got overwhelmed, where life was too much, these parts of us will come forward and we'll really look around at the world and we'll say, am I safe? Am I going to be met here? And as someone who's an educator working in mindfulness education, that's the moment where it's key that we're competent and we're up for the ride. Because if you're going to do mindfulness, I think you're inviting depth. And so can you be there in that moment and say, I'm right here, and we're going to get you the help you need, and we're going to welcome this. And I think that can be a very life-affirming experience versus if it opens it up and you're like, whoa, 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 I actually don't know how to handle that. That's a bummer, and that's not life affirming at all. And for most of the people that are listening, I think that they'll be wanting to work in the direction of life and say, yeah, we want people to grow and change and open. So trauma is just one more way to say, cool, let me have the tools and the competency to meet people skillfully and then make sure they're happier and healthier after they are with me as one link in the chain.
So beautiful chatting with you, David Trelevin, author of Trauma Sensitive Mindfulness, coming hitting bookstores soon. And any ways they can get more information or contact you if they're interested?
I have to get a website. Maybe they can just look me up.
Look him up, David Trelevin. And tune in next time.